Blog Talk Radio.
This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Fitness Buff Show, the leanest, fastest hour on radio. Check it out online at fitnessbuffshow.com and start getting fitter and faster today. Jolton Joe Sinnott. You have to be pretty damn good at what you do for someone to name you Jolton. The name stuck to Jolton Joe DiMaggio, of course, and it's also part of the eternal legend of Jolton Joe Sinnott. Unless you're a comic book fan, you may not know Sinnott. But if you recognize the names of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, Jolton Joe will be forever connected to their accomplishments. Lee wrote the stories, Kirby drew them, and Sinnott inked them, starting with the first issue of the Fantastic Four in 1961, on through the first appearance of the Silver Surfer and beyond. He's also contributed his talents to Thor, the Hulk, and Captain America, to name just a few. Sinnott is the subject of a new oral history called Brushstrokes with Greatness, compiled and written by Tim Lasuda. It's packed with illustrations from his 50-plus year career, starting with a timely comic story called The Man Who Wouldn't Die, on through the development of the legendary Marvel Universe. Joe, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hey, thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure being here.
Glad to have you on. Let's start with a general point of information. What on earth does a comic book inker actually do, and how do you explain your career to the layman?
Well, actually, it's all I ever did. I drew from the time I was 3 years old, I can remember, and it's the only thing I knew. All my brothers could, they could build houses, they could do all that. I couldn't drive a nail, but I could draw, and I drew all the time. I drew on paper bags, whatever I had. Things were tough growing up in the 30s, but we made the best of it, and, it paid off in the long run, I guess.
Well, what is the difference for someone who doesn't know between someone who does pencils and someone who does inking?
Well, there's all types of penciling, Bob. Some people, years ago, most of the artists used to pencil thoroughly, and complete pencils, put the blacks in and everything. And it progressed down to the point where a lot of the artists would pencil very loosely, like a thumbnail sketch, and the inker, if he was capable, was required to finish the art. So he really was a finisher. Not all artists can do this, but some came and can, and fortunately I was able to. Of course, the first 12, 13 years I was with Marvel, I did my own pencils and inks, and that's the way I used to like it, but that was a different world back then.
When did it change for you? When did you stop focusing on penciling?
Well, I started at Marvel 1950 with Stan.
Right.
It was Timely Comics back in those days. And around 1961, he had asked me to do Jack Kirby didn't do his own inking, and he asked me if I could fill in and do a Jack Kirby. He couldn't find anyone to ink it, and so I inked it, and Stan liked it quite a bit. He liked the combination, so it progressed from there, and Stan just kept sending me more Jack Kirby stuff, and I felt I could make as much inking as I could penciling, so I proceeded to ink primarily for Stan, and of course I had other accounts, Treasure Chest and Dell and whatever, and there I did my own pencils and inks.
So I wondered about that, if you could actually make as much inking as penciling. I would have guessed not, but from what you say, I guess that you could.
Well, it seemed like I could, you know, maybe because I was a faster inker than I was a penciler. A lot of times with penciling, you had to research and do things like that used up a little of your time, but you know, it never seemed to be a problem with me. The inking came very easily.
How different is one man's inks from another? I mean, yeah, and again, we're, you know, if we're describing this for people who really aren't that familiar with it, I mean, some people would just think, oh, inking, you're just taking an ink pen and going over someone's pencils. But it's more than that, right?
Don't I wish. No, I felt down through the years I've added a lot to whoever I was working on, and I'm sure a lot of my friends would tell you the same thing. Some inkers, I must say, do, so to speak, ink over the lines that the penciler has put down, and other inkers have to do a lot of what we call finished art. We have to finish the art. Some pencilers don't put any blacks in whatsoever, so that whole, or detail, and the inker has to do that. He's primarily, like I said, finishing the art. He's completing it. He's adding to it. He's an embellisher.
Hmm. What do you think is the difference between the art you were inking in the early 60s at the peak of, well, the start of the real Marvel age, and today? Has it changed?
Oh, a great deal. Of course, you know, being up from the old school, I prefer the old method, and I feel things are too technical today, and too slick, and they don't look like a comic book should look. That's my feeling, and of course, the old days, everyone did this same type of art. The reproductions were basically the same, and but it looked like a comic book, and that's my. You know, it had the classic look, and you know, I prefer the Kirby, the Buscema, the Colin, the Romitas, and you know, it was just great. It was stylized, but it was realistic art. Whereas today it's hard to say what the new method would be called. But we're influenced a lot by the Japanese today, as you know.
Mm. And have the changes?
Not my preference.
Have the changes had anything to do with improvements in printing technology? I mean, you get a finer printing today than obviously you did 40 years ago.
I'm sure there has been a great change in printing, obviously. And, of course, we have better paper. And but then again, here we go. The old comics, you know, they had that old comic book feel to it.
Mm.
And a lot of people that I know, well, especially people my age, certainly prefer the old classic comic style and reproduction.
I guess one of the things that I think of when I think of your work in the 60s, is particularly with working with Kirby, was that the lines, it was a heavier line, it seemed like, the thicker, heavier line in those books than maybe we would see today, or maybe even in some other books. Is that a mistake? Or
no, I think you're correct in that regard. I know, looking back, when I worked on Kirby in particular, I used an awful lot of brush, and certainly with a brush you're going to get a heavier line. And but Jack's work, it almost demanded a brush, because he had big bold pencil strokes and usually 4-5 at the most panels on a page, and you could really do big drawings, and you could get in there with a brush and let yourself go. And it's not like today when I'm inking the Sunday Spider-Man page for Stan and the King Features, I use an awful lot of pen. The drawings are so small, and they're reproduced so small that you have to use a lot of pen, because the brush is just too big, the lines would be too heavy.
Mm. What you had worked in comics for 10 or 11 years by the time that first issue of Fantastic Four came your way. You had seen the superheroes go away, westerns come on, things like that. When that first Fantastic Four came to you, what did you think? Did you think it was another monster comic? Was it a big deal at the time, or was it just another assignment?
It was no big deal at all. And when the Fantastic Four came to me, number 5, I had never heard of the book, and but as soon as I saw the characters, I said, gee, what great characters. And, of course, in those days, as you know, through the 50s and 60s, we were always looking for a new trend. You know, during the Korean War, we had the Korean War, then we had the horror comics, and we had romance, we had science fiction, and then we had the monster books in the late 30s and early 60s. I mean, the late 40s, I mean, and early, excuse me, the late 50s and the early 60s. And then when Stan came out with a few superheroes, we didn't think anything more of it. We thought, even Spider-Man, we just thought it was another character.
Mm.
And, you know, that it would soon fade and we'd be doing something else. But certainly, as you know, it caught on and took off.
Now, I think I need to correct myself on something. You actually, from something you just said, you actually came on Fantastic Four with the fifth issue.
That's right.
Not the first issue.
The introduction of Dr. Doom.
Ah, okay. And how did the whole perception of the industry you were working on start to change in the early 60s as these comics took on kind of a life of their own that they had not had in the 50s?
It was pretty obvious. Most of the comic houses, and we were dropping houses at that time, really concentrated on the superheroes and DC, of course, and you know, with their Justice League and Batman and Superman and whatever, they brought them all back. And the same with Marvel. Only Marvel created more characters. Of course, we did have Captain America and a few like that. But basically, we had all new superheroes. And as we know, they proved. Since I think Stan was surprised that they were so popular.
And Stan created kind of a cult of personality around everyone who worked on those books, didn't he?
He certainly did.
How was that different than the way the industry had operated a decade earlier?
Well, that's pretty hard to ascertain, Bob. I really wouldn't know how to put a finger on it, tell the truth.
Well, what did you think? Now, Stan nicknamed you Jolting Joe Sennett, but there was a nickname before that, right?
Pardon me, Bob, what was that?
I'm sorry. Stan nicknamed you Jolting Joe, but he had given you a previous nickname even before that, right?
Yeah, I don't know why. He had called me Jovial Joe.
Were you surprised? Were you surprised the first time that popped up?
No, not really. I don't know where he got it from, but Jolting Joe, I could understand that because I'm sure he was influenced by Joe DiMaggio, you know.
Right.
And I used to talk a lot about baseball with a friend of mine that worked in the office down there, Jack Abel,
mm-hmm.
a very talented individual.
And in the 60s, and really the late 60s, early 70s, I mentioned cult of personality. It was a changing time. I mean, people were actually knew your name. They knew what you did. They knew other people. It wasn't just a matter of they bought their favorite comic. They were looking for people's names, and they were recognizing people, right?
Oh, I think so. You know, I often hear from people that said, you know, I rooted for you, so to speak, and I looked for your work way back in the beginning of the superhero age, back in the early 60s, 61, 62. And, you know, I remember many years ago I had the first fan mail I ever got was back in 1953, I think it was. And this kid from Connecticut called, or he wrote me and said how much he loved my character, Arrowhead. Now, he was an Indian renegade, the law was always after him, but he was always helping out those who were in trouble. And the book ran for quite a few issues, and I really enjoyed it. And this kid wrote to me and said how much he loved Arrowhead. They finally made a movie out of that. Charlton Heston played a character called Arrowhead, and here again he was an Indian. And it was a fairly successful book for the 50s, and I kept his letter all these years, and the last letter I heard from him, he said he was going off to Korea. This was during the Korean War, and for years, I never heard from him again, and it was interesting because I thought maybe something happened to him during the war, and I had lost his address. But anyway, about 2 years ago, I got a letter from this woman from Connecticut, and she said she was this person's wife that I had known when he was a kid, and that he was very sick. He wasn't expected to live anymore. His illness was terminal. So I got together some of the old arrowhead drawings that I had done many years ago, and I sent them off to Roland. And of course, he couldn't respond to me. He was aware that he got them and everything, and he passed away about a week later. But I'm sure I made his last couple of days fairly happy, because he loved that character.
What a wonderful story!
Yeah,
what a great story. Now I wanted to ask you. You've had a business relationship with Stan for, 57
years.
Yeah. How different was Stan in 1950 from the man who this year is hosting a weekly TV show?
I can't see one bit of difference.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Stan was always, he was the life of the party, so to speak. If Stan was in a room with 1,000 people, he would stand out, you know. And great sense of humor. His memory's a little bit off now, but even back in those days, he wasn't known for his memory. But tremendous sense of humor. I wish I could tell you some of the stories, because whenever I vouch for my work, Stan sends me a little note back, and I've kept them all. I have hundreds and hundreds of Stan's notes and letters, you know. And someday they'll make a good book, I think. Really, you can't believe the sense of humor he had. And always with a smile. If you ever see a picture of Stan, it's with a great big smile, you know. But he could be tough, too, though. I mean, he knew what he wanted, and he expected it. And but he certainly helped me in many ways. You know, he always, right from the start, I remember when I was just a kid out of school, he said, "Joe, whatever you do, exaggerate everything." He said, "I want everything exaggerated, you know." And that's what we've lived by, you know.
What about Kirby? Did you work with him? Obviously, you got pages from him, and I know that while Stan developed this idea of the Marvel bullpen, it was largely, you know, there were some guys working on staff, but most of the guys worked from home. So
that's right.
So you didn't see each other that often.
Now, most of the guys who did the books worked at home. The staff, of course, involved so many people, you know, proofreaders, people who did corrections and things like that. Of course, Romita, of course, worked there at the office, and there were a few others. Kirby, I worked with Jack, must be 18 years, something like that, and I had never met him. Never talked to him on the phone. Would you believe that?
Wow.
And so the Marvel had a convention in 72. And I went down, and I was introduced to Jack Kirby by Murray Severin. And I didn't see him again. I didn't talk to him again until 1975. They had another convention. And I went down, and we got together. We had a great 3 days together. And after that, I never spoke to him again. Would you believe that? And, of course, Jack moved to California, and he dropped me a note once in a while if he wanted something. For example, if he wanted one of his characters inked, and he'd ask me that way if I could help him out, and, of course, I always did. And but we never talked about the Fantastic Four. He never told me he was like the way I did this, or I didn't like the way I was doing that. We just never talked about what we were working on, which is amazing, I think, you know.
It's, to use the Marvel term, it's astonishing, really. you guys only met twice in all those years, and
yet
your work is so closely tied from that era.
I never discussed the work, never.
I'm baffled. It's
really. Of course, Jack and Stan used to write notes on the pages, for each other, if Stan wanted something changed, or if Jack didn't like a certain way the story was being told or whatever. But when Jack sent the work to me, there was never, ever a note on the border saying, Joe, would you do it this way or would you do it that way? And, of course, we did. I can't remember. My son knows all the pages we did together.
Mm.
But it astonishes me, Bob, sometimes also.
Do you have any guys that you were particularly close to from that era, from Marvel?
No. It was pretty much the same as Kirby. They sent me the work, and they knew I was going to do a complete acceptable job when I returned it.
And where were you living at the time?
I've lived in Saugerties all my life.
Really?
Yeah. I was born here in 1926.
Wow.
And I went to the Cartoonist and Illustrator School in New York City for about three years, I guess it was. So I lived down on 74th Street and Broadway. Other than that, I moved back up to Saugerties here when I got a firm account with Stan.
Mm-hmm. And that school you went to later became the School of Visual Arts.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, Bern Hogarth was one of the directors there.
I think I saw that Silas Rhodes just passed away.
Oh, yeah, well, I'd say it was been about 2 or 3 years ago now.
Oh, really? I thought I just saw something.
Oh, wait a minute. I thought you meant Bern Hogarth.
No. Silas, I think I just saw...
I didn't know that he passed away.
I think he was like 92 or something.
He was.
Yeah.
He was... What a dynamic... They both were. Unbelievable. Both characters were dynamic personalities. And, of course, Silas had been in the Marine Corps during the World War II, and I would hate to have been under him, I'm telling you. What do they call it? Not slave driver, but there's another word.
Do you have a good story about him?
Well, we used to call him Rocky when we were in school, you know. And he'd come around every day, certainly. And I'm telling you, he was a dynamo. He was a strong person, and you could just see him in the Marine Corps. And a lot of stories, little stories, you know, that he would tell. I remember one time he told me, he said, Joe, he said, you're putting on weight. And he said, it's not good. He said, you know, it's very unhealthy. And I'm sure he was a health nut because he looked like he could take on a weightlifter. And like you just said, he lived to be 93, right?
Yeah.
It's funny to think that as many times as I've talked to him, that's the one thing, of course, two things. That's the one thing I remember him saying to me, Joe, you're putting on a little weight. And I wasn't aware that I was, but obviously he could see it. But another time when I went down to the school to apply for entrance, I had my little pencil and ink scratchings, you know, and I was very apprehensive about it because I thought they weren't good enough to get into school, you know. So I went to see Silas Rhodes. He called me in, and he looked at my work, and he said, Joe, this is really good stuff for a beginner. And he said, I got to show these to Bern Hogarth. And I was saying to myself, he's just saying that because they're having trouble getting people into the school. He wants to make sure I come to the school, you know. And so he went in and showed the samples to Bern. And, of course, Bern came out and told me, he said, Joe, these are pretty good for a guy at your stage. He said, yeah, you're a born car. I wanted to be an illustrator, so I wanted to take the illustrating course. And Bern says, no, Joe, he says, you're a natural-born cartoonist. He said, I'll tell you, it's not easy. It's very hard work. He said, but your work would lend itself perfectly to, you know, being a comic strip or a comic book cartoonist. So that was the first day I was down to the school, and certainly both of them impressed me so much at the time.
Well, I mean, just for people who don't know Bern Hogarth, do you want to explain?
Yeah, well, he was the illustrator for the newspaper strip Tarzan. It appeared in the New York Mirror back in those days. And, of course, he was a great draftsman. And we used to love to have him come in and draw on the easel for us. He could draw anything you wanted, a saber-tooth tiger or whatever. He was just a dynamic person and a great great artist. He really was.
I mean, for a lot of cartoonists, especially in the action genre, adventure, I mean, he's the gold standard, isn't he?
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's certainly one of them, you know.
So when you come in there out of the blue and Bernd Hogarth tells you, you know, you've got what it takes, that must have been a pretty exciting day.
Yes, it was. And, of course, the one thing he told me, I had come out of the Navy, and I didn't go to school right away when I came out. I was playing ball, having a good time, whatever. So then it came time, and I said, no, I got to go to art school. And so when I went down there, I was at the, you know, we were doing some drawings in ink, and I was using a pen. And he came by me, and he knocked the pen out of my hand. He said, Joe, he said, in this school, we use a brush. And he was a great brush man. And I didn't even, here I was about 20, 21 years old. I wasn't even aware that cartoonists used brushes. That's how naive I was. But, see, in those days, there was no conventions. You had no chance of ever meeting a, especially up here in the mountains of the Catskills. I never met a cartoonist and never had the thought that I ever would, you know, whereas today the kids, you know, they see cartoonists all the time at these conventions and they know everything about the field even before they try to break into it. They know what supplies to use and what brushes and what pens and whatever. But all I used was a post office pen that they used in the post office, you know, the ones you dip in the ink well.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I did this biography of Will Eisner, and I remember he told me about taking his portfolio up to see Ham Fisher,
right,
who did Joe Palooka, and James Montgomery Flagg was there.
Oh boy!
And yeah, who did the, of course the famous Uncle Sam posters? And the big deal for him was he was just so overwhelmed. He didn't know what to say to the man, so he says, what kind of pen do you use? And Flagg said, I use a 290 Gillette. And so Eisner went out and bought nothing but 290 Gillette pens and used them for the rest of his life.
Isn't that amazing? Of course, Ham Fisher, the school used to get a lot of calls from people and in the business or whatever, and they got a call from either NBC or ABC, one of the TV stations. There was only three at the time, and they wanted someone to come over on, I forget whose program, but Ham Fisher was the guest over there, and they wanted an art student to come over and talk with Ham Fisher about comic strips. So they used to send me on a lot of these errands, and so they called me up and from the class, and they said, Joe, Ham Fisher wants you to come over and ask you a few questions about school, things like that. And I said, oh, I'm afraid not. I said, I'm not, in other words, I thought I was too shy to go on TV, you know. So I passed it up. But so they chose another friend of mine from the school, and he went over, and he came back, and he said, you know what? I said, what? He said, Ham Fisher was showing the people on the easel how to draw Joe Palooka. And he said it was already drawn. He said it was in blue pencil, and you couldn't see it on, you know. But he was tracing it, he said, you know. But, hey, those guys weren't taking any chances either, you know. And another time, Ted Mack, I don't know whether you remember Ted Mack.
The original Amateur Hour.
Yeah, he's before your time. But anyway.
I wish.
They called me over well, it was the Amateur Hour. It used to be Major Bowles' Amateur Hour. They have still called it that. But in any case, I was sent over there. So I did go over there, and I was up in the booth with him, and we were watching. I still remember the old gold, the mother and the daughter. They were inside a cigarette pack, and they were both dancing on the stage. You remember that commercial?
I remember dancing cigarette packs.
Yeah, well, that was old gold.
Wow.
So anyway, we watched that, and Ted's agent was there, and he wanted me to do a caricature of Ted for Variety magazine. And I'll tell you, I was nervous. And he said, "Now make Ted look like a nice guy, because he's really nice, you know." And actually, he was a nice guy, really nice guy. But he looked like somebody from Guys and Dolls. So how do you do a caricature from someone who looks like a gangster, you know? I'll tell you, I was scared to death. And I kept rolling away, and Stan kept saying, his name slipped my mind. Ted Mack. Ted said to me, Joe, don't be nervous. And he said, in fact, after we finished this, it was about 4:30, quarter to 5, he said, I'd like you to come over with me over to the, one of the big nightclubs. Could have been Herman Billingsley's nightclub, you know. And, I just couldn't do it. I said, Ted, I really can't. I made up some excuse. I was just too scared. I really was scared. I was just a kid then. Mm. And it would have been interesting. Looking back, I should have gone, you know, to see whom he would have met over there and whatever, you know.
Well, to borrow the title of your biography, you had another brush with greatness, although I don't know if you actually had contact with him. I suspect you didn't. You did a comic based on the Beatles back in 64, right?
64. Just before they were on their way over to see Ed Sullivan's show, or to be on Ed Sullivan's show, and Del called me. They knew I did good likenesses, and they wanted someone who could do likenesses. So they asked me to do the Beatle book, which was 64 pages long, and I had a month to do it in. That was a lot of work in a short period of time, and it came out really good, and all things considered, and they. They were very happy with it, and of course I never did get to meet the Beatles, but but the book is fairly unique, and it's fairly rare, I guess, you know.
And that was a project that you did the drawing for.
Pardon me? What do you mean by that?
You drew the Beatles for that. That wasn't an inking job like you were known for much later. You drew the Beatles pages.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the book. A good friend of mine, Dick Giordano, he helped me out on a few pages towards the end. I was running out of time. And, of course, Dick and I used to work many years ago together. I would pencil, books for General Electric or Radio Shack, and he would ink them, you know. And, of course, that was an interesting period, you know.
Now, I want to ask you about one more thing because we're running out of time. This is the summer, of course, that the Silver Surfer actually comes to life. I wondered if you have seen either of the Fantastic Four movies, and if you have, what you thought.
Don't embarrass me. No, I haven't seen them.
Really?
Would you? My family, my son, he's a big comic fan, and he knows all about the comics, and he took his two children to see it. Of course, they wanted me to go with them, but it was the first night, and I really didn't want to go the first night because they get a lot of young people the first night, you know, and... In fact, they packed the theaters, no question. I did see Spider-Man number 3 the first night, and it was hectic. I mean, the kids, they were quiet and everything, but there was just so many of them. I had to wait in line and all that, you know. So anyway, I didn't see it, but my son Mark, he's quite a critic. He loved it. There were a few little things, naturally, he disagreed with. But he thought the Surfer was tremendous, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. I thought they did a great job with the Surfer. And my daughter, who's the upcoming comic fan in our house, she loved it. She just absolutely loved it. And
yeah, John Buscema and I did the first three Surfers.
Right.
Of course, he continued with his brother for a while. I think they did maybe 17, 18 issues altogether. But I thought, what a great character the Surfer was. And, of course, John did it. He did a beautiful Surfer.
I think you have to go see the movie, not just to see what they did with the Silver Surfer, but I think you'll get a kick out of Stan's cameo in this particular movie.
That's what Mark said. It was the first couple that he was in.
Yeah.
You could barely see them. You had to, you know, don't blink, otherwise you'll miss them. But I understand he had a little more...
Yeah, you can't miss him in this one. It's a very funny moment, especially for someone who's known him as long as you have.
He just called me about 2 days ago, and I was away from the Spider-Man for a while because my wife had passed away, and I was quite sick for a while. I was in the hospital 3 times.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, over the last 5 months, so I had a... hand over the Spider-Man to a friend of mine, and he very graciously, took care of it while I was laid up. And so I went back about maybe a month ago, and so Stan had to call me and tell me how great it was to be back and working with me, you know.
That's great. That's great. Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Sounds like we've only passed 5-10 minutes.
I know. It goes by very quickly.
I know. After you hang up, you'll say, gee, why didn't I ask him this? Or I'll say, why didn't he ask me that?
Well, and again, I appreciate it. And folks, you can order Tim Lasuta's History of Joe Sinnott, Brushstrokes with Greatness, on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. And if you'd like to keep up with Mr. Media's Friday interviews, you can subscribe to the site via email at www.mrmedia.com. You can also subscribe to the audio feed in the podcast section of iTunes. Thanks for joining us. Please come back next week for another Fridays with Mr. Media.
Hey, Bob, thanks a lot.